How to create a teacher shortage in two easy steps. First, demoralize them, then watch them leave. How do we fix this problem? That will take a lot more work. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Slate.com, they were trained for this moment. How the student activists of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High demonstrate the power of a comprehensive education.
Quote, the students of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School returned to class Wednesday morning, 2 weeks and moral centuries after a tragic mass shooting ended the lives of 17 classmates and teachers. Senator Marco Rubio marked their return by scolding them for being, quote, infected with arrogance and boasting. The Florida legislature marked their return by enacting a $67 million program to arm school staff, including teachers, over the objections of students and parents. Senate Republicans on Capitol Hill opted to welcome them back by ignoring their wishes on gun control, which might lead a cynic to believe that nothing has changed in America after yet another horrifying cycle of child murder and legislative apathy. But that is incorrect.
It's very incorrect.
Very incorrect. This is awesome, right? We talked about this last week in the news, and if you didn't pay attention to last week's news, you can always go back to BustedPencils.com and check out the podcast because it's there. But we talked about the fact that, first of all, these students right after the shooting were being, quote, coached, and they were being criticized for being coached because of how articulate they were on TV. And there's just no way that kids 17 could actually be so articulate.
Right. How could they even have that capability?
And now we're 2 weeks later, the fact that they've amassed such a mass following and a boycott, as you even said, right?
Yep. It says their boycotts may not influence lawmakers, but they certainly seem to be changing the game in the business world. They've jumped over the lawmakers, went right to business. How do kids do that?
My God. Well, you know how they do that? This is the best part. And it says, a really good education, which is something we at Busted Pencils have been saying and saying and saying, is that if you give kids the right education, and in fact, even in this article in Slate, they refer to it as a 1950-ish style of education. Well, really what they're talking about is actually the kids get civics, they get art instruction, they get music instruction, they have tons of extracurricular activities, they have drama club, they have debate club, they prepare for these things. So in other words, they have a, as they said, comprehensive education. Now, guess what's showing as in this moment? A comprehensive education makes for very comprehensive young adults.
Right, exactly. They know what they're talking about. They're articulate. These kids have debate programs from middle school on.
Right. So what we take here is, first of all, congratulations to the students there that are doing this work. Love it. But let's take the lesson which is being taught here. Let's stop cutting out education. Stop cutting social studies. Stop cutting music. Stop cutting art. Stop cutting extracurriculars, all in the name of going after test scores or, quote, achievement scores. Because the reality of that is, and I've said this before, is you're not fooling anybody here. When you go after those things, those don't help test scores. They actually hurt education intentionally. And what intentionally results is that you have a very apathetic student body that doesn't know how to advocate for anything.
From the Huffington Post, exclusive, Florida public school teacher has a white nationalist podcast. Diana Volatich suggests Muslims be eradicated from the earth, believes anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and teaches middle school social studies.
Well, there's a teacher.
Everyone needs a full-time job, right?
As somebody would say, she's just providing balance to that lefty liberal public school system out there that's inflicting socialism on all those kids.
She threw the needle way over, didn't she?
This is frightening in a way, that this is a real teacher who has a real podcast about white nationalism. Now, this story broke a few days ago. And since then, just to put an update out there, she has a lawyer because she's been fired.
Right.
Okay. That's a good thing, we hope.
Right.
Because white nationalist podcasting, hating Jews and Muslims,
and teaching social studies
to kids shouldn't probably be a good mixture.
Right.
Okay, so she's, but her lawyer has pointed out that it's actually us. We all have the problem.
Oh, not her and her podcast.
Not her and her podcast, right.
Love to hear this.
Yeah, she's not very good at it, but this was satire. She's a satirist.
She's a bad one.
Well, that's
or
not...
Or are we bad?
Who knows?
Everyone's
but
bad.
The reality is that this, she's not a real white nationalist with a fake Russian name. She's just putting satire out there for us to consume. Now, never once in any of the podcasts did she ever make reference that any of these things are satire, and in fact has had many guests on expressing all kinds of views, such as, for example, the science behind IQs and the fact that certain races, well, science has proven that certain races are just smarter than the other ones.
Science has proven. Yes,
this.
And she said a kid from Nigeria and a kid who came from Sweden are supposed to learn exactly the same and have the same IQ. She agreed with the guests and went on to argue that science has proven that some races are smarter than others.
Yeah, and that was
science.
Satire.
That was the satire part.
Right. Didn't get that part. I don't buy it because great defense, I guess. She's just a really crappy satirist.
Yeah.
Okay, she's just really bad at it. Just because you all didn't get it doesn't mean it's not satire. No, in fact, she has her podcast name as Tiana Dolokhov, right?
Right.
So she's got a whole fake name and everything out there. The fact that, you know what happened? She got caught.
Yeah. And it seems like the kids knew this was happening, said stuff to parents, and she told the principal, not happening.
Right. In fact, earlier, it's like, hey, the kids are like, she's kind of like off the deep end with some of her thoughts and things she's teaching us.
Right.
Like, and the principal confronted her, and no. She didn't claim it's satire. She just said it's not happening. But this is a teacher who got busted. Okay? Teachers do stupid things just like any other stupid person. Here's a stupid teacher who had a podcast out there where she was showing her real colors, trying to use a fake name and have a podcast, who got busted. Guess what? She got fired. Oh well. Bad satirist, bad teacher. I don't give a crap as long as she doesn't teach kids again.
From theconversation.com, with teen mental health deteriorating over 5 years, there's a likely culprit. Around 2012, something started going wrong in the lives of teens. In just 5 years between 2010 and 2015, the number of U.S. teens who felt useless and joyless, classic symptoms of depression, surged 33% in large national surveys. Teen suicide attempts increased 23%. Even more troubling, the number of 13 to 18-year-olds who committed suicide jumped 31%.
This is all between a five-year period.
Those are some big numbers.
Those are some big numbers. I mean, this is seriously troubling right here when you look at those numbers to say between just in that short a time span. The issue here is to always ask why. What's happening? What's going on? Because this is
something tipped a scale.
This is not right. This is not the typical reaction. This doesn't follow. The stats are way off the charts on this. So something must be going on. And so we hopefully employ some type of research to figure this out. And according to this, theconversation.com, there was a new paper published in Clinical Physical Psychology that found the answer.
And the culprit is?
The culprit is cell phones.
Yep.
Screen time.
That's the culprit?
That's the culprit.
So if we throw away the cell phones, all this is going to go away?
All this is going to go away. See, I will criticize the overuse of technology from an educational standpoint at any moment. I have a problem, though, with this piece being so absolute in its cause and effect relationship between, quote, cell phone screen time and teen depression / suicidal tendencies.
Well, because when you and I talked about this before, it kind of seems like a, well, no duh.
Right.
Because, you know, you read this and say, well, of course, kids are in front of their screens. They're not spending time socially. They're going to get depressed. They're seeing their other friends are having fun. And it makes all these other numbers go up.
Right.
But
we've got to ask deeper questions and before we make cause and effect. So this is kind of either lazy research or lazy journalism, because the other factors that are contributing, I will absolutely, what the hell is going on between 2010 and 2015 to make numbers jump like that? That's a serious question that needs to be answered. To quickly say
cell phones,
and we've proven it, I'm pretty sure there are many variables that you haven't looked into. And in fact, when we get into research and research terminology, confounding variables, conflating variables, all these types of things that go into this, is going to say this is not so simple. Is there a contribution to isolation and being on a cell phone and isolation leading to feelings of depression? Probably. Mm-hmm. However, are there lots of kids on cell phones spending lots of time who are not depressed?
Yes.
So therefore, then, the, quote, cause and effect relationship has to be called into question. The same with the easy solution to why are kids so violent? Well, they play violent video games. It's absolutely guaranteed that's why. No, there's tons of kids that play violent video games that aren't violent at all.
Right.
Okay? So we have to be very cautious whenever somebody comes up and says cause and effect. No. Do we have a correlation here? Yes, let's make sure we understand the difference.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
You want to know what we really have a shortage of? Hold on a minute. I wrote the following over a year ago. Quote, the Department of Public Instruction, in partnership with a host of other groups, released proposed changes to teacher licensing in the state of Wisconsin. This leadership group cited the teacher shortage, enrollment declines in teacher education, and school administrators' need for flexibility when placing teachers in different grade levels and subject-specific content areas. However, other than creating some flexibility for administrators, the proposed changes do little to address the teacher shortage and will likely increase inequities across the state by promoting fast-track teacher education and an emergency licensing system lacking any incentives to promote full licensure. More specifically, the proposed changes ignore the exodus of teachers across the state and the nation and the plummeting enrollment in teacher education programs, end quote. That was 1 year ago I wrote that. Where are we today? Sadly, we are still talking about the teacher shortage. Maybe it's time we talk about real shortages. Teachers have a shortage of classroom supplies. Teachers have a shortage of classroom support personnel. Teachers have a shortage of time to plan. Teachers have a shortage of real wage increases. Teachers have a shortage of retirement benefits. Teachers have a shortage of mental health supports. Teachers have a shortage of curricular autonomy. Teachers have a shortage of decision-making ability to do what's best for kids. Teachers face a damn shortage just about every day. How about some other real shortages? Well, let's look at this. We have a shortage of education leaders advocating for the needs of children. We have a shortage of politicians with any understanding of the complexities associated with teaching in today's public schools. We have a shortage of people with any clue as to why we have a so-called shortage. And this results in crap solutions that actually drive the real problem. Teachers are leaving the profession. That is not a shortage. We have an exodus. But why? It's because teachers have been demoralized, and every solution to the teacher shortage problem actually accelerates the demoralization process that is killing the profession. So where's the real shortage? Look around, because it's everywhere. We have a shortage of bravery in every elected official that fears actually calling out the planned process of demoralization that is truly killing the profession. And in my home state of Wisconsin, that's not just the Walker Republicans. It's the do-nothing Democrats in elected positions, especially in our Department of Public Instruction. A Department of Public Instruction unduly influenced by the Eli Broad Academy that continues to push license deregulation so that, quote, alternatively certified teachers can continue to demoralize the teaching profession. Yes, we have a shortage, but it's not teachers we're short on.
From Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
She is Associate Professor of Education and Chair of the Education Department at Bowdoin College. She is also the author of the new book, Demoralized: Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Doris Santoro.
Thank you very much.
So, Doris, demoralized, this is, you know, as a teacher educator and a dean, and people know that, that's my other job on the side of Busted Pencils. I picked up this book and I looked at it and I just, the title was enough to go, this is someone who gets it. We're going to talk about what it is, but the idea here, though, and I just want to point this out, is that the reason you came up with demoralized, though, is because we're actually moving away from the difference between, we've heard teachers burn out. And am I right to say that it's not, maybe not the motivation, but for you, through all your investigations, finally coming up and putting this book together, says, we're not looking at burnout here.
Exactly. And I think that one of the big reasons why I care about distinguishing demoralization from burnout is because if we are diagnosing the wrong problem, then we can't treat it the right way. And so when we're thinking about teachers as burnt out, it also really diminishes what they are trying to do and the concerns that they bring, because it sets them up as people who are just failures, who couldn't keep it together long enough.
I mean, burnout's a real concept, though, right?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And there are definitely people who, you know, were not able to set enough boundaries, where the demands of the profession, which are incredible and increasing all the time, really wear you down. But what I'm talking about with demoralized folks, they were not in a state where they could, where they had nothing more to give. They still were often considered some of the best teachers, and still are considered some of the best teachers in their districts or their schools, and are incredibly committed to doing the very best they can at their work.
And so here we are then, we're looking at this and saying, okay, this burnout, sure, some teachers burn out. However, we're facing a totally different issue here, demoralization. And though its big connection for me is that we have to tie it to the reality that we're trying to talk to, particularly people in power and legislators, for me. We've got a, quote, teacher shortage in this nation. Mm-hmm. And if we're diagnosing that teacher shortage as the, and one of the causes being burnout, when the reality is not that, we've got a real problem. Explain that.
Exactly. Well, we actually don't have very good information about why teachers leave.
Okay.
We know that teachers are very dissatisfied. We know that from U.S. Department of Education data. We know that from the MetLife survey. We know that from the AFT Badass Teachers survey. There's a lot of data out there that's letting us know that teachers are dissatisfied, but we don't know why they're dissatisfied. And so my study asks us to start thinking about, might there be another question that we need to ask? But the other thing that I want to say is, we don't need to wait for more data to start addressing this problem. We should not be wasting our time saying, well, let's develop a better survey.
Right.
Sure, let's go ahead and do that. But we could also start thinking about that teachers enter the profession by and large for moral reasons. They want to do good by students. They want to do well by their discipline, the profession, for the civic reasons that bring them to teaching.
Yeah, and that's
what.
You were going right where I wanted to say, because I think one of the things about the moral idea and then being demoralized, we need to explain for a listener, particularly who might not be a teacher, what you talk about, though. I mean, why do most people go into teaching? You started talking about these moral moral reasons. I mean, wanting to make a difference is an oversimplification, but that has some kind of sense of a moral grounding. Anything else that I'm...
Making a difference, contributing to knowledge, contributing to the well-being of others, contributing to the well-being of the nation. Anything that's other regarding, that's something bigger and beyond yourself that you think you're contributing to, that could be a moral motivation that you're bringing to the work.
Okay. So, and that's it. I mean, this is not, when we understand, this is a profession, and professions hopefully have some kind of moral underpinning that pushes people to do the work. Mm-hmm. And so, in as you just said, I mean, you've got a comprehensive book here, Demoralized, Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay, that really go that really goes deep into, and I love the case examples, and we're going to talk a little bit about them, but the idea that we need more and more surveys and more research, I would also say, I mean, if you're on Badass Teachers on Facebook or on any of the activist Facebook pages, one only needs spend maybe 2 days before you run across, or you run across a demoralized teacher expressing that demoralization on Facebook. Mm-hmm. When we look at those, we put that in combination with your book and say, yeah, we don't need to go and stop doing or I guess maybe the other frame is to say we should start acting, because if we do have an issue of demoralization, then we've got a problem of teachers leaving. And I guess it took a really long way around to getting there, that we have a leaving problem.
We do. And, you know, the impending teacher shortage, Richard Ingersoll has long shown that the shortage we have would actually be remedied by retaining teachers. So we don't have a teacher supply problem. We have a teacher retention problem. And that's why I studied experienced teachers. And the teachers I spoke with had from 5 years to 35 years of teaching experience. And I spoke with them about what do they need to do good work?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the good work. And so when you say good work, again, this is connected to that moral work. And so somebody says, mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean good work? They're raising test scores. That's good work. That's what you mean, right, Doris?
Mm. Well, you know, I mean, in the sense that if you believe that raising test scores is improving equity for students, then maybe you would consider that good work. But the problem comes not when it's motivated by equity, but what happens when teachers are focused only on the test scores, and what are the results what impacts their practice when they do that? When we see teachers who say, "I'm not doing good work anymore," and just to say this idea of good work, I didn't come up with it. This comes from Howard Gardner, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and William Damon, and they say that good work does two things: it serves a social purpose, and it fulfills that purpose in a responsible way. So it can't just be, look, we raised test scores, but what are the means by which we're raising test scores, if we are, in fact, even doing that? And, you know, when I talk to teachers who are mortified by the fact that they feel as though they're harming students as they watch students crumble in these tests, develop anxiety, watch a student with cerebral palsy take quadruple the time to take a computer-based assessment that's really just assessing his fine motor skills rather than his content-based. So it can't just be what are the results. It's also the means by which the work is done.
Right, and I kind of set you up for that because hopefully, and when anybody who's out there goes and gets the book, one of the, I think you see it a lot, is that actually it's this, it's an oversimplification, but this push to raise test scores seems to really get underneath the people you're talking to as being, you know, it takes away from them doing, quote, good work. And to say maybe if there is a test score and there's some connection to equity, but by large part, particularly since No Child Left Behind, I think we see an increase in test scores for test score's sake. And you're starting to hear a lot of teachers talk about that. We are talking to Doris Santoro. She is the chair of the Education Department at Bowdoin College. She is the author of the new book, Demoralized, Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay. We are talking with author and chair of the Education Department at Bowdoin College, Doris Santoro, about her new book, Demoralized, Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay. And when we left, we were going to talk about a
somebody suggests a solution is that these darn teachers just need to get more resilient.
Right.
And Doris, what say you on that? I mean, the problem, you know, these teachers, they're just not resilient.
So I'd love to give a very quick example of a teacher named Yessie.
Okay.
And the day that I was interviewing Yessie, I'd flown to New York City to see her. She still saw me. Her mother-in-law had passed away the day before. In her first year of teaching in New York City, she was publicly humiliated by her teacher in front of her, by her principal in front of her students. She continued teaching. She then taught for several years and decided that she was getting stale. So then she went and applied for a new job within her same school as a science teacher rather than a social studies teacher. I mean, so she is this paragon of resilience. Resilience sets it up that the problem is with the inner lives of the teachers, that if they could just bounce back and be able to roll with the punches a bit more, everything would be fine. But what teachers are doing is they are letting us know that something is very, very wrong. Mm-hmm. And so they are giving us great insight into something amiss with their profession. And so to think that they should better accommodate and adapt to what's going on leaves us with a situation where we might be ignoring the very, I don't know how to say this, the very
problem that
we should be addressing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this to me, when I read through this in your book, this is the same grit resistance or resilience argument that, mm-hmm. that Kip uses for kids.
Yep.
And, you know,
yep.
and it's a blame the victim type of thing where it's like, look, it's their fault that they're not more resilient, that they don't have, you know, more grit in these things. And it mm-hmm. doesn't address, as you said, the issues that actually cause people to be demoralized. And
right,
so you were talking about Yessie. Now, for the Wisconsin listener, if you're out there, you can buy this book and check out Paul.
Yes.
Right? And so give us a little picture of Paul.
Right. So Paul is, he is an Eagle Scout. He is someone who is always prepared. He sees the sort of democratic and civic purpose of his work as paramount importance. And, he was demoralized, not because he is not able to be resilient, but because he was inundated with nonstop changes mm-hmm. to what he was expected to do in terms of building curriculum, where he was vilified as public enemy number one, and in fact even had to change his barber because the rhetoric in Wisconsin became so anti-teacher that he could not even go get a haircut without having to feel attacked. And he, is one of those people where in the face of all of this, he didn't throw up his hands and say, forget it. He ended up building binder after binder of figuring out ways to help his colleagues navigate the onslaught of changes that they were facing. And so he has all kinds of resilience. You know, he didn't sit there and just get berated by a barber. He
right.
went and found a new barber.
There you
know,
go.
He didn't say, oh, this is just too much for me. I'm going to crawl into a ball and hide. No, he produced this binder that I thought nearly would break his kitchen table of all of the changes that the teachers in his district had to incorporate into their practice in a very short amount of time, and screenshots that he offered to help his colleagues make it through this turbulent time. So he was not suffering from a lack of resilience. What he was doing is saying, I want nothing more than to be someone who is respected in my community because I take my job incredibly seriously. And that part of his work was completely taken away from him.
And that's the story that I think, you know, whether you're a Wisconsin listener or not, I mean, Wisconsin particularly, Act 10, Governor Walker, it was, and as you described it, Doris, an onslaught. So any Wisconsin teacher who's listening to this right now identifies with Paul, understands it, and yet they're still out there because they're holding on to something that, you know, whether we want to call it resilience, but they're holding on to something else and they're still going forward. But if we're going to recognize that these teachers are demoralized, and if we recognize that retention is what we need to do with our teachers, we don't want to lose them, we can't replace them, we can't get fast track certification, we can't deregulate the license, we can't find alternative pipelines, because that actually, read the book, those contribute even to more of the demoralization. But you introduce a concept, though, that says we can go after this, and in fact, Paul's an example, but it's called remoralization.
Absolutely, and the most important piece, I think, of remoralization, and this is based on the ways in which the teachers I interviewed were able to reconnect with the value and purpose of their work, is when they engage in authentic professional community, when they are able to connect with people who share their commitments for good work. And sometimes those may not be people inside their building. It may be through online communities. And sometimes even online communities then help them recognize who allies are nearby. I would also say that, you know, while sometimes the practice of, or the strategies for remoralization may include activism, they do not need to include activism. They may be student-centered action of that you reorient what you're doing and you say, I'm going to constantly look at what's good for kids here. I'm not going to worry about the other piece. Sometimes it's voice, and it can be voice being used anonymously through blogging or something like that. It might be teacher leadership where you're working with other teachers in your building, in your district, across the nation, to try to move forward on a particular issue. But really, within all of that, professional community is the key. I would say one other thing that I would that I was surprised at as a teacher educator who depends on experienced teachers is that I really am always very hesitant to ask more of teachers when they are so inundated. But what I found through this research is actually collaborations with institutions of higher ed can be some of the most remoralizing, engagements that teachers have. And so I've tried to reframe that what I'm asking for, if we can in some ways ensure that that is a reciprocal relationship that involves thinking about doing good work together, that actually can contribute to remoralization rather than just be another thing that we're
right.
adding on.
And I actually love this idea, and it's in the book too, because, you know, being a dean of a school of education, I do not see us as some island where people, quote, come to learn to teach. And in fact, we, in keeping in that position, probably add to the continued demoralization. But this reaching out part and making, you know, professional community, teacher mm-hmm. education institutions working hand in hand with teachers, working hand in hand with schools, working hand in hand with parents, very, very similar to what Ken Zeichner is calling in Teacher Education 3.0. If we do these things together, we can be a force of remoralizing all of us, because I have to say, even at this point in my profession as a dean, fighting off every type of new idea to, quote, grease the pipeline with unqualified breathing humans to, quote, teach our children, it's a bit demoralizing even being in teacher education. And I need that remoralization that I get when I work with teachers in the field who are still passionate, that still feel wonderful, that still want to do good work, as you say.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons I love talking to teachers about these issues, both because I can see their passion and commitment to the work. And it it inspires me to make sure that I can amplify their voices and let folks know about what they're facing when they're trying to engage in this good work.
Well, the book is Demoralized, Why Teachers Leave the Profession They Love and How They Can Stay. The author is Doris Santoro from Bowdoin College. Doris, is there, other than Amazon and .com, any specific place we can go to get your book?
You can go to Harvard Education Press, and I would love to encourage you to visit your local independent bookseller.
Okay, and we will bring that. Well, Doris, as we say here, I mean, you've remoralized me to continue this work, and for that, thank you, because you truly have busted pencils.
Thank you.
From Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
She's a lifelong resident of Madison, went to Madison West High School, attended UW-Madison, got her bachelor's degree in elementary education, taught in Texas, and then came back to Madison, ran for school board, and is now running for school board again. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Anna Moffitt.
Well, thank you for having me, Mr. Slecker.
Texas!
Texas.
So all this Madison, you went down to Texas, spent some time teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Then said, I got to come back to Madison.
Oh, yeah. It was way too hot.
To be a school board member. Right.
That's well, what, I taught a little bit before I got on the school board.
No, but we're here. And so you are a candidate for the Madison School Board. You are actually finishing a term. Mm-hmm. And you are currently the vice president of the Madison School Board. But you're up for reelection.
I am.
And so why should we reelect Anna Moffitt?
Well, I think I've really done a outstanding job the first 3 years that I've been on the board. Okay. I came to the Board of Education with a education background. I had a lot of experience already working with the school district on a lot of different policies and procedures just as a parent advocate. And so when I ran for the school board, I definitely came with my laundry list of things that I felt we needed to improve on.
So in that time, yeah, like I think a lot of people, when they go into the school board, there's issues that they want to address. And sometimes those issues aren't necessarily good. But it sounds like what you were coming at, you said a laundry list. But what do you think was your best accomplishment or your biggest or the one you're most proud of?
I think I'm most proud of the fact that I've really used the power and discretion of a school board member to put in budget amendments and create budget amendments in places where I feel like services and supports aren't being adequately funded, and putting forward those budget amendments and actually having them folded into the annual budget.
So an example of one that when you say it makes the difference, so where did one make the difference?
Well, this past year, I think one budget amendment that I worked on was in regard to the intensive support team. I'm sorry, not the intensive support team. That was the year before. I did Circles of Support, which is a program that's here under Dr. Jeff Lewis.
Right.
And really it's for specifically elementary school kids, kids of color in our schools, where they really get a team of people that wrap around them and build a really nice system of support for them within the school and within their home and the community. And we've seen really great results from it. And it was being funded through a grant. But I said, hey, we're seeing good results. It's time for us to pick up the tab.
So there we go. So here's a great program. Circles, instead of sending kids to suspension, Circles comes in, creates a situation in which relationships become integral. Mm-hmm. Not only do suspensions go down, but kids actually end up liking school, end up liking their teachers. Teachers end up liking them.
Yes.
Funded by a grant, would have gone away. Anna Moffitt said, no, we need this to be part of the budget. And boom, there it is.
It's part of the budget.
There. Okay, cool. So, I mean, that's one of the things that a school board member does is a lot mm-hmm. with budget, though, too.
Yes.
But are there other issues where advocacy beyond money or just issues pop up? And if there are, I mean, what's one for you that is a special area?
I would say an area that I focus a lot on is on behavioral health and mental health.
Okay.
That's kind of outside of the school board. I obviously have another job because we really get paid nothing as a school board member.
What?
Yes, I know. It's hard to believe.
Oh, my God. I thought that was a luxury job.
Yeah, no, we're still waiting for those Escalades.
Okay.
Don't tell Chris Rickard.
Okay.
I'm just kidding,
we won't.
Chris.
We won't. But, I mean, so you were talking about there's a passion part of.
Yeah.
Around
behavioral health. I mean, and we did several years ago, I wasn't on the board at the time, but we did
approve the behavior education plan, which was a huge shift in how we look at discipline and behavior. And it moved us more to restorative practices and away from punishment because we weren't seeing good results by punishing kids, expelling them, suspending them, secluding, restraining them. So this was a different way to look at behavior and how we can change challenging behaviors. So I think that's been a lot of my work, just getting people to think about that, shifting the idea. A big thing I talk about is kids do well if they can, not if they want to. So if a kid, all kids want to do well, but if they're not doing well, there's something that's getting in their way.
So you keep talking about kids as mm-hmm. if your job of school board member is to advocate for what's best for kids.
Mm-hmm. In part.
it's nice to hear that because so often some school board members seem to be in it more for political posturing and or stepping stones into political careers instead of recognizing that as a citizen of the school district and a school district that's a public school system, a school board of people who live there, you're supposed to be doing what's best by kids, not what's best by politicians.
Most definitely.
Do you ever feel any pressure, though, to not do what's best by kids?
Yes, there is pressure. There's always pressure around us, especially in the political climate that we live in. I mean, we're coming out of, 7 years of being asked to cut our budget year after year after year, and that's totally being driven by outside politics, mm-hmm. corporations, and the Republican Party trying to prevent kids from having a high-quality public education.
Yeah, how do you deal with that? 7 years of, you're trying to do what's right, you put in a budget amendment to make sure Circles, you know, a program that supports students doesn't leave. But at the same time, you have a state mm-hmm. that is defunding your public.
And a federal government.
And a federal government now, too, particularly.
Yes.
right? Defunding you. How do you balance that? How do you make it work? And I don't mean how do you balance the budget, because I know that's the issue. But how do you work through those tough issues?
I think it's a challenge. It's the hardest part of our job because many times it does come down to cutting services and programs or reallocating resources that we really should be keeping where they should be. And not having the adequate staff that we need to have things be done well. So we do have that challenge. I would say on the flip side, though, in Madison, we're really fortunate. We have a community that strongly supports our public schools, and we have many community partners that offset some of those cuts. So I always try to explain to people in Madison, we're actually very fortunate. I think as you move out of Madison into more rural areas, this situation is much more at a crisis level because a lot of those supports aren't there.
And those partners, I mean, how much work do you get to do then with partners and reaching out, maintaining those partnerships, developing them? Is that part of the job as school board member?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I enjoy doing it. I mean, you have to be out there talking with people. And I think it's always a balance because you want to make sure that people understand we have good, strong schools, but we also have some areas of challenge and limitations. And so how can we invite people in to get us to where we want to be?
So coming into the new election, you obviously want to do this again.
Yes.
For no money again.
Mm-hmm.
and you like behavioral and mental health, so we might want to check that out for doing, no, but right.
But everyone should have a therapist in my
opinion. I have radio and I talk to you guys. You work as my therapist, but what's your, maybe not a single issue, but as you're coming into this, I mean, what is it that's driving you for a second term?
I would say the three big things that are really driving me in the second term is continue to have this really strong focus on behavioral and mental health. I think there's more that we can do. I think there's a lot of need in our community, and it will continue to grow as we see the impact of what's coming down at the federal and state level for our kids and families. I think the other big area where we will be looking for more partners will be in the area of early childhood education. Right now we have half-day 4K. I think we need to bump that up to full-day 4K and even half-day 3K in targeted neighborhoods. And that's going to require collaboration across the county and the city and community partners. The other area that I think I'm really excited about, and I have a meeting tonight with these folks, is vocational and technical education. So we have very few programs in the school district that provide high quality education in the area of the skilled trades. Very few internships, apprenticeships. I think that's an area that we need to look into. We have kids that the college prep for your go of things isn't for them, mm-hmm. and they shouldn't be denied an opportunity like looking into the skilled trades.
Is there a support page or anything that people can go to find out more about your candidacy?
There is. It is Anna Moffitt for Madison.
Okay, AnnaMoffittForMadison.com. All right, and we will put that on the Busted Pencils website. But you know what, Anna, at this point, you've got an endorsement from Busted Pencils and Tim Slecker. So
yes.
Thanks for busting pencils.
You're welcome.
Ingrid Henry Walker spoke up at a school board meeting and was asked to leave. So we asked her to come to Busted Pencils and speak up about the schools our children deserve.
Children deserve schools that focus on instruction, not testing, that have a shared leadership structure where everybody has a voice in that school. They focus on a culturally relevant curriculum. They have supports for our families. They don't punish children, but they figure out ways to positively work with them and work on different behaviors. And they involve the community.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Voting is easy and marginally useful, but it is a poor substitute for democracy, which requires direct action by concerned citizens.
My thanks to Doris Santoro, Anna Moffitt, Ingrid Henry Walker, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.